talking about some of the answers that these counselors of Job are bringing to him, and how when you read them individually, that many of them are very helpful, and you can think of situations where they would be helpful, or maybe some of them have even been helpful to you. Because these are the best kinds of answers that religious counselors are still using. And as we said yesterday, if you read in some of Paul's epistles, other places in the New Testament, you will find some of these same kinds of answers, these rationalizations to try to explain suffering that appear there also, are also some of these in number B. And I noted particularly for you chapters 4 and 5. See, if you read on through Job, you find the same kinds of arguments being brought up again and again and again, all the way through those chapters, all the way up to chapter 27. So we've just looked briefly at some of those at the very beginning, presented by Eliphaz. Now one other, some of those answers are things like God does act in history, and that there is sense in a reaffirmation of the idea that people bring things upon themselves. There was the answer that all human beings are sinners, and therefore they should not expect that there's no trouble in their life. There was a statement that life is tough, that we are all born to trouble. There was the rehearsing of the good deeds God has done in the past as a hope for the future as you look on ahead. And there's one other, the idea that chastisement is good for us, that God disciplines us for our own good, that kind of answer, which is a very common answer to the question of suffering that is dredged up again and again and again. And all of these, as I've said, are true, and yet you cannot absolutize them and apply them to everybody. Our problem is that sometimes we've had a particular answer that has really helped us to hold it together in times of crisis or despair, and then we want to make that particular question or that particular answer fit everybody else. But it won't always work that way. And sometimes what is a good answer at one time will not be at another time, depending upon the kind of specific situation that we are in. So, the context of Job is that all of these kinds of good answers are being rehashed here, but the point is, Job is not satisfied with any of them. And before we leave B here, I want to point you to just a few places where Job now is replying to these people. What's he saying to them after they are unloading all of these goodies? One place we'll look is Job chapter 9. Or let's look first at 7. Chapter 7. Let's briefly look. Do we have Bibles? There's more up here. Somebody else wants to. The King James Version, and I'm going to be reading from the RSV, but chapter 7, verse 11. Therefore I will not restrain my mouth, I will speak in the anguish of my spirit, I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. This, of course, is Job talking. Am I the sea or a sea monster that thou settest a guard over me? This is Job speaking to God. When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then thou dost scare me with dreams and terrify me with vision. That's kind of a direct way to talk to God here. You can't even get any rest when you lie down and try to go to sleep. You can't even get rid of your anguish then because God comes with vision, with a nightmare. And this line about, am I the sea or the sea monster that thou settest a guard over me? If you look down in verse 17, it would be a follow-up of that. What is man that thou dost make so much of him, and that thou dost set thy mind upon him, dost visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long wilt thou not look away from me? Now let me alone till I swallow my spit. If I sin, what do I do to thee, thou watcher of men? Why hast thou made me thy mark? why have I become a burden to thee? Now, that's really powerful stuff, and that's honest. Remember back in that first chapter where you had God bragging about Job. And Job is now asking, why are you paying so much attention to me? You know, what is it to you, God, that you have to keep such a close eye on me and you have to keep sending me all these problems? What are you doing it for? What have I ever done to you? What if I do sin? What's the big deal? How does that hurt you? Now, I don't know if any of you ever thought like that or not. To me, there's a really liberating sense that this kind of way of addressing God has been given the sanction of being part of our Holy Scripture. So that in fact, if that is the way you feel, it is all right to say it. Because it is all right to talk to God about where you are, right? At the immediate moment, what you think, what you feel, and that you don't have to somehow be someone else in order to come to God, but all you have to do is be who you really are. And we hope we aren't like this very often, but there are times. Okay, let's go on to chapter 9. The whole problem here in 7 was the idea of why is Job being picked on? Why him? Why all that attention? As if he were some real threat to God, like the symbolism of the sea. Chapter 9. Verse 14, beginning with verse 14, where you have the idea that God is both the judge and the jury. There's a sense in which God has all the cards. How can anyone possibly prove his innocence before God? Because there's no one else you can call upon. Now, what kind of a referee or umpire is there between God and the man? The man doesn't have a chance. Because God, in fact, is that judge up there. And if you think you've been dealt with unjustly, who do you go to? You know, who do you appeal it to? Nobody. So you've got to go to God himself. And there's a sense that Job has here, if God is condemning him, then how can he go to God to ask for a fair deal? Okay, you may think that's kind of a perverted way of thinking about God, but that's where he was at this particular moment. How can I answer him? Verse 14. Choosing thy word with him. Though I am innocent, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. It's like in the Missouri Synod, see, where you go to Jack Croce for judgment about the accusation that Jack Croce made about him. Well, how are you going to get by with God, who Job feels has accused him, punishing him for some reason? So how are you going to go to God? So how can you go to your accuser? If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not let me get my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a contest of strength, behold him. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am innocent, my own mouth would condemn me. Now, obviously, the kind of, you know, Job gets a bit self-righteous here, I suppose. Although at the beginning we did hear that he is innocent and blameless, we begin to revolt a little bit, at least good Lutheran types who always talk about how sinful they are, that a human being would talk like this. And yet, again, it's here in the Bible, it's a kind of openness and honesty toward God, which you would not want to copy, but at least you should have the freedom to do if, in fact, you do feel like that. I just want to point out in verse 24, the earth is given into the hand of the wicked. Well, let's say verse 20, beginning with 22. It is all one, therefore I say he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who then is it? God, that is. In other words, if there's injustice in the world, then whose fault is it if it's not God? say it's the devil, you can say it's somebody else, it's our own problems, and yet God ultimately is running the show. Job says, you know, if there's injustice, then who else is there to go but you? Okay, powerful stuff there. Let me move on. I'm still looking at the answers that Job, or that is the response Job is giving after his three counselors have unloaded their, you know, their idea about how he might be helped. And this is the kind of response they're getting. So in the next to go around, when the counselors come back to talk to him again, they're going to be a little more testy. You hear they've unloaded all the best stuff that they know that has worked many times, and people have always said, thanks, Pastor. And now all of a sudden, they're getting this kind of response from Job. So next time around, they're going to be a little more suspicious of him, and they're going to believe, well, maybe you're not so innocent after all. Look the way you're talking. See, you're proving by the way you're talking just where you're leading up. That's what they're going to say the next time. One other chapter that I really like, chapter 13. Now let's read a little bit beginning with the first verse, chapter 13. Lo, my eye has seen all this, my ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you. Job's talking to these counselors. You get the impression here, and also way back in chapter 4, where Eliphaz, when he first begins to talk to Job, says, you know, Job, you know about this. You've counseled with people before. But now when you're the one that's hurting, none of this makes any sense to you anymore. And they sort of give Job a little bit of a bad time about that. It's funny how much easier it was to understand it when it was somebody else's problem. But when it happens to Job, then the theology didn't work anymore. And here we have Job himself saying this, you know, don't give me, I've heard all that stuff. I've used it myself. My counsel people said the same things, but now you're telling me that, only it doesn't mean anything to me. What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you. These wise counselors coming with their wisdom, and Job says, I know all that stuff, but it doesn't work. But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue my case with God. And all the way through the book of Job, there's going to be a building up to the fact that there's going to have to be a confrontation between Job and God, because the sort of human answers that are coming aren't doing. And there's more and more dissatisfaction on the part of Job with even listening to this. As for you, verse 4, as for you, you whitewash with lies. He's talking to his counselors. Worthless physicians are you all. Now, some of you are pastors out there, and you know, if a person in the congregation talks to you like that, it's hard to be completely objective. You can't get involved in the words that you say. Worthless positions are you all. I've had people say things like that to me, and it really is a little hard to be pastoral. Oh, that you would keep silence, and it would be your wisdom. Sarcasm, and we have already mentioned how when they were silent that first week that things went better. Hear now my reasoning, and listen to the pleadings of my lips. Will you speak falsely for God, and speak deceitfully for him? Will you show partiality toward him? Will you plead the case for God? Will it be well with you when he searches you out, or can you deceive him as one deceives a man? He will surely rebuke you if he seeks you. You show partiality. I think that's a terribly significant little group of verses there. Beginning with verse 7 through 9, and through 10. When you speak falsely for God, deceitfully for him, show partiality toward him. That is, if you know, you know, way back there somewhere, that things aren't all that simple, and here you are trying to make God look good. That is, if there's a conflict here between Job and God, why do you have to jump on God's side? That is, you always bend the argument so God looks good, so that somehow you protect the name of God, that you make God look good and not be responsible for any of this nasty stuff, but it's all Job's fault. You keep heaping the abuse on the human being. And God, you know, it's like our task is somehow, even if we have to bend the truth a little bit, to make God look good.
Our task is to jump to his defense.
Well, somehow, someone, when they're saying things like Job has said, we got to protect God from that kind of talk. And Job says, God will get you for that. God doesn't need that kind of protection. But you have to tell lies in order to protect them. But rather, you better speak the truth, because God knows what the truth is. And you need to understand what's happening, but why do you always have to pick on the human being? Why is in our theology, you know, it's a kind of Lutheran theology that puts such an emphasis on original sin that every bad thing that happens in the world is our fault, but we don't get credit for any good thing. Every good thing is because God did it in us. Every bad thing is our fault. Well, there may be something like that. That kind of bothers you. I heard a sermon once on this text, when you lie for God, pious talk that doesn't fit the reality of the world that you see it, as you see it, but you have to lie for God. You somehow got to protect him. You've got to do propaganda for the Almighty. Well, that's powerful stuff, and yet we all slip into that. Okay, I think that's enough of just a brief sampling of Job's responses, the kind of thing now that Job was saying. And just to remind you one more time that what we have in the book of Job, in the major part of the book, after that introduction, is this cycle back and forth of a word by one of the counselors, Job's response, and each of the counselors gets three tries. So that's just a sampling of the kind of stuff that is located there throughout these conversations. Now, maybe some of you would like to say something at this point. Might be a place to pause for just a minute before we go on to see.
I'd like to ask if there's any particular reason why use of Shaddai is that we're aware of. Here's some Bible makes note earlier to intended usual. Calling upon the old, calling upon the old name of the patriarch.
Yeah, I think we can only speculate. He's talking about there are different names for God. In the prologue, it's all Yahweh. And also in the epilogue. But here, when we get into the poetry, you have some of these old names for God. El Shaddai in Exodus 6. You read there when Moses is being confronted by God, who's telling him to go back to Egypt. And he said that you know me, if you knew me as El Shaddai, but from now on you'll know me as Yahweh or Jehovah. Is it some kind of mistakenly translated? And El Shaddai is apparently an ancient name. Maybe even before Abraham, you know, it probably got something to do with mountains or strength or something. We're not exactly sure. But I don't know whether there's some plea back to some ancient archaic religion or not. I don't know.
I guess maybe good should be dumped on God, and people believe that the bad is dumped on man. And you said that bothers you. It bothers me too. Who do you dump for that?
Well, that's the question. Who do you dump that? That's what this whole question is about. Where does it come from?
Don't we bring it upon ourselves?
Well, see, that's what everybody is saying, and the book of Job is challenging that does not always happen. The whole book of Deuteronomy, the whole history as it's told through Samuel and Kings, the prophets, they all talk about how we bring evil upon ourselves. And I really do believe that in most cases there's truth to that, if not individually, at least collectively. And maybe the fact that I have to breathe bad air in the middle of the city because I live next to a steel mill, that's not my fault, but I'm part of a society that has done that. And therefore, we brought it upon ourselves. The fact that we invent machines and cars and kill people, and all kinds of things we bring ourselves.
That goes back to the punishment,
I think. Mm-hmm. And then we look for,
whether I did it or whether it's just because we are living close together with other people that somebody else might have done. But there are, of course, all kinds of things that you can explain that way. Unexplained illness that comes to a good person, or things like mental illness, somebody just seems to go off and nobody knows why, and it's tragic. Even things, you know, why did God make these flies and mosquitoes? Why did he do that?
Fish
God must like fish. So I think ultimately you have to say that, as Joel does, that it's God's responsibility. And that's why I think that in times of utter distress, it's God that we ought to talk to. Because he's ultimately responsible. He made this world. He made human beings what they are. He set up the kind of patterns of cause and effect and all of that. What happens in the world when you do this, that happens.
That's how you're defining responsibility.
He's got the whole world in his hands. This is God's world. This joke says that if he's not responsible, who is? Who else are you going to turn to? Nobody else.
It doesn't sound like relate to the fall. I mean, because of the fall, why this exists?
Yeah, and that's the whole answer, that it's the human being's fault that you brought it on yourself. And as I say, that'll work most of the time. But even there, you know, you can raise the question of, well, why did God make humans that were going to goof up the minute they had a chance? It would start getting too logical.
That all goes back to the punishment thing, and that does not jive with God at all.
Seems like Pastor Funky's hour has a lot to say to us.
Yeah, you know, I missed that, and I heard that I should have been there.
Yeah.
Does anybody want to summarize something from that? What did you have specifically in mind?
The sentence from John Bright in The Suffering Servant.
Yeah.
Picture, he says suffering isn't merely the consequence of the servant's task, but the organ of it. And so we get beyond the question of who caused suffering and we go to what's it good for.
Yeah.
And that's what Pastor Funke seemed to really, to me, dramatize so beautifully, that this Bethel institution is a living proof of people having value for each other and the redemptive value of say somebody who is sick, the sick person, the unwhole person.
But didn't he say that it doesn't always work, or it doesn't always work right away, or something? When he was using that text about all things working together to good, part of waiting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That it isn't clear.
There is, in fact, of course, the point that we don't know exactly where the suffering comes from or why or like that. And at least existentially, the thing to do, the problem is when you do it, when it's here. And we do, of course, keep raising those other questions because there are some difficulties in our understanding of God. You can raise questions about human freedom and so on here, but I think, at least it's been helpful to me, that is, unless you have a kind of a robot or something, that there are going to be possibilities of people hurting one another. If there's any kind of human freedom at all, that means that there are choices that are going to sometimes be the wrong choices.
But there's also the individual, for example, the epileptic, who has had no choice.
But there's a larger picture too, where we've been given so much in ability, in resources, and we've chosen to use these often so poorly, mainly to destroy one another or purely selfish. I mean, if we would have applied these resources and abilities, probably long ago we would have had the answer to epilepsy. So if he
he's turned the garden over to us for us to care for, and we've done such a poor job, and we can't leave it undone for that either.
Where does the concept of evil as a force come into this whole picture?
Well, that's, you know, that's part of the picture.
I think that we're sort of ignoring it in this conversation.
Well, we have talked about it some. We were talking about Satan at the beginning of the book as well. But where does that evil come from? See, that, you know, we haven't really solved that question. We can talk about a devil or a Satan, at least as some sort of a urging to do wrong and so on. But if you personify that too much, then you end up with kind of an extra god, see.
Isn't the concept of Satan or evil not in existence apart from God, but only a deprivation or a, switching the words, but a cheapening of God, just doing everything in a evil way means that if there wasn't God to begin with, there wasn't goodness, and there'd be nothing to corrupt, and that evil is merely the corruption of good. It's a classical position that means that we have the ability through free will to corrupt good, and maybe Satan did this as a free angel to choose to make himself a god. But he couldn't do it unless he was in the creation to begin with. And if there was no God, there would be no evil. If there was no good, there would be no evil, because there would be nothing to corrupt. It doesn't exist simultaneously or independently of God.
Yeah, well, those are, in a sense, rationalizations at a higher level, where you begin to philosophize about things. And again, the answers are right. Satisfy some others. I have trouble really jiving with that kind of stuff. I think there may be truth to it, but it doesn't really hit me at my core. So.
It's the part to take the philosophy and bring it home, that with free will we also have the ability to corrupt good. Given a good and evil, given a good relationship, we can make it a poor relationship.
Yeah. If you have human beings with freedom, you can do that.
From a secular standpoint, I think that phrase, evil will prevail if good men fail to act, I think probably God is saying, hey, look, you're going to have to do something. Look at all this happening out here.
Anybody want to say any more at this point? Let's look. I think this next group, there are a couple of passages there that I want to just kind of look at here. So when we get all done with this little thing, what are we going to say is the Christian way of understanding the presence of evil? Well, I don't know if there is just this precise one. I think the dominant view is still that human beings are the ones that are responsible for bringing evil into the world. And when you talk about human freedom that rebelled against the Creator, the whole fall thing, and then you can even look at individual cases where that has occurred. The problem is to apply that all the time and to all individual lives. But that's still a dominant biblical way of understanding evil. It's the result of the rebellion of human beings. The book of Job is an effort to try to just modify that enough so that people don't take that and apply it all the time to their individual lives and continue to feel guilty and alienated from God because evil comes into their lives. We're trying to find some other ways of handling it. So we're looking at all these other kinds of possibilities. Now, one thing that helps is if you have some sort of belief that God eventually will set it straight. See, if you're going to, maybe everything doesn't fit together right now. You don't understand it all. You see through a glass darkly, all that kind of stuff. But someday, God is in fact going to show that he is both just
and merciful, that he loves us, he's going to get rid of all the pain, all the weeping will go away, that there won't be any of the kinds of trials that we have in this life now. So that's a dream about what God might do someday. And there are rationalizations about why he doesn't do it yet. Why doesn't he do it yet? Is it because he's waiting to test us a little longer? He wants as many people as possible to be faithful to him first. He doesn't want to shut the door while there's still a chance somebody might come in. Those are other kinds of questions that go with that solution. At the time of Jesus, there was a messianic hope that in fact God would send a new Messiah, that there would be the kind of peace on earth and removal of pain and so on that people were looking for. Of course, it didn't happen. That's one of the reasons the Jews don't believe that Jesus was the Messiah. The Christians interpret that in a more spiritual way rather than the down-to-earth practical way that the Jew would interpret it. And so that we then talk about a kingdom of God that can't be seen, a kingdom of God that's not equated with any kingdom on this earth and so on. And we've come to think about eschatology, last things, in terms of our own death, usually. So that most Christians nowadays don't think that there's going to be that complete turnaround so that this world is a perfect place, but rather we will find that kind of rest and ultimate justice and so on in our own death. We believe in the resurrection, that there's some sort of life beyond this. That all of those apparent cases of injustice in this life, there's still a chance that they'll be corrected later on. So everything doesn't have to happen now. The problem with especially earlier Old Testament, some of the earlier prophets, is that they don't have that kind of sense that there's an afterlife, that this will all be corrected. And that's why there was such an urgency that there be proper treatment of people in this life. And that's why a person like Job is in particular problem, because he is being judged now in this life. And people are assuming that he must be a sinner, that he's suffering like that, and so that now he is branded as someone who is suffering. There's no place where that will be made up later on. Or is there? Maybe there are a couple of passages that at least might hope in that direction. Also, along eschatology, one version of that is the kind of view that the world is going to end in a big blast, and there'll be a battle, and apocalyptic types that think we have the signs now with the Jews back in Israel and so on, that the world is going to end pretty soon. And there's a little revival of that a few years back. I think it's fading away right now, but every once in a while that comes up to the forefront, and people think that there are signs that it looks like the end is finally coming. So that kind of a view is really the basic biblical view that we bring sin on ourselves and so on, but now there's an extension of time. We've got a little more time for God to work that out. It doesn't have to all happen now. There's an open-endedness about it. But does Job have any of that? Let's look at chapter 16. Let me see, verse 18. O earth, cover not my blood, and let my cry find no resting place. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he that vouches for me is on high. My friends scorn me, my eye pours out tears to God, that he would maintain the right of a man with God, like that of a man with his neighbor. Well, there's something here about a witness in heaven, whatever that means. Talks about don't let the earth cover his blood. There seems to be, I think, what's going on here, the sense that Job, when he dies, when he's buried, he doesn't want people to forget that. He wants someone to vindicate him, to somehow make the word known that he has not died as a sinner, but he is in fact a righteous man. He wants someone to restore his good name, but there doesn't seem to be any hope that he himself will come back to life and live a painless, eternally happy existence. At least there seems to me to be a hint of that. The other passage that I want
mention is in chapter 19. Beginning with verse 23. Or that my words were written, or that they were inscribed in a book, or that with an iron pen and lead they were graven in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at last he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been thus destroyed, then from my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side, and my eye shall behold, and not another. Now, what on earth does that mean? I know that my Redeemer lives. We have hymns about that. Handel's Messiah has this great passage. Is it the Trotto that sings that? This particular passage. I don't know if you're using a book that has the footnotes in it, but my RSV has all kinds of footnotes there, because this is a text that is very difficult even to translate, let alone to interpret. In verse 25, where it says, "For I know that my Redeemer lives," there's a footnote that says, "or vindicated." That would be the Redeemer. It would be, like I mentioned a few minutes ago, one who redeems someone's good name. In the Old Testament culture, there was a person called a Goel, who was a redeemer, whose job was to set the thing straight when somebody was killed, for example. And at some point, this meant blood vengeance, where if someone was killed by someone, then you had to kill someone in that family in order to get the thing straightened out so that it was now even. You were the vindicator. Or if somebody has been... their good name has been maligned, that you would try to recover that good name. Even though they are gone, the name still continues, or their reputation. It also says, at last he will stand upon the earth, and there's an alternate, it could say, on the dust. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, then from my flesh, but it could also mean, or without my flesh, I shall see God. And then there's a footnote at the end of that that says the meaning of this verse is uncertain. That's verse 26. And whom I shall see on my side, and that says, or for myself. Now, these are all possibilities. There are different ways of translating the Hebrew. The text is kind of garbled up. Does that mean that Job expects prolifically? After my skin has been thus destroyed, from my flesh I shall see God. That could imply something like that, but it's so uncertain that you certainly couldn't build much of a case on
that. This Good News version uses, while still in his body, I will see God.
Yeah. What was the... it says, the RSV says, from my flesh I shall see God, but another possibility would be without my flesh I shall see God. What does the King James say there?
In my flesh.
After my skin has been destroyed, in my flesh I shall see God. I don't know what that means. But this... See, a point that comes up here is one of the ways that helps us to deal with the problem of evil, and it certainly came up in the little discussion we had yesterday about rejoicing as Christians, because we do believe in an eternal life, and God is merciful and all of that. But if the Old Testament folks did not have that notion that there is some sort of eternal life, and then the evil becomes even more acute in a way, because here it is right now. We've got to get it all straight now. This is the last chance. Maybe there's a chance that you can at least restore someone's good name after they've gone. It seems to me that that's about all Job is hoping for.
In the Jerusalem Bible, it says, after my awakening, he will set me close to him.
After my what?
Awakening. He will set me close to him.
Yes, but you see, that may be translated. Well, the problem is with the verse itself, with all of these ambiguities, that you can translate it with just a little hint in that direction that may or may not be there originally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may be.
This, I will see him with my own eyes and he will not be a stranger. It's more a hope for a real relationship, yeah. Not just to be vindicated. Right. That's this one. This thing.
And what was that in our, whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. Well, you know, we could look at this a long time, and I guess we wouldn't really know exactly what it means, but it's a fascinating passage. It's one of those that you wouldn't like to know.
One thing that you brought up, I've been wondering about, you say that if he would take care of God, vision and resurrection or after from a logical standpoint, from a rational, what are you concerned about? Just have a good time. You marry and for the moment you die. Why they don't come out with it?
Well, there's some that you do have that in the book of Ecclesiastes. But you don't have that view as long as you believe that there's a God who has called your people, called you and your people to be servants of His. And in fact, then you have this notion that that there is some connection between the way you live and what happens to you. So you can't just do any darn thing you want to, because that's going to make some difference.
It's like being good for goodness sake, you know, in that sense. Yeah. And whereas the Christian community, oftentimes sometimes feel we're good because we're not, we're going to get it. Whereas, and I wonder which is really the higher morality. You know, we get for goodness sake or being good because I'm going to accomplish it right now.
Well, why, what's our motivation for doing good as Christians? Is it so that we can make it to heaven? I mean, if that is the only motivation, then certainly our motives are not at a higher level than most folks.
That's the sub-Christian.
Sub-Christian.
Yeah.
Probably not anybody who can hold a bell,
Jim.
It's hard for us to imagine, and I think this question really illustrates it, how people can live with hope who do not believe in a resurrection. Because in fact this world does have pain and all of that. But even if you've had a really good life, you don't want it to end. You know, you don't want it just all to suddenly come down.
The question is, were hope also bound up with our children? They would go through that, something like that.
I think that there was a sense of community that those folks had that we don't have. Of a community that went before and that follows after. I think we try to recover it with things like roots, you know, and that popularity. Now everybody wants to know what their ethnic background is. A few years ago, everyone wanted to forget that. They want to all be like everybody else. And there is a kind of sense of being part of God's ongoing people that I think that each of you would have felt. And if you have descendants and you know that God still works in them, and in a sense you are part of them, that the individual identity was not quite as monumental in importance as it is for us. See, for us, we have to think in terms of myself, Dan Simonson, who's going to live forever. And I can't think so much in terms of my people, my descendants, those who belong to the same religious community. But rather, I got to be somehow there myself so people know who I am and there's some similarity between who I am now and what I am in the future.
Are you saying that, then, from the Jewish point of view, eternal life was not a concern of theirs insofar as they're living themselves? They might live in their children. Is that a general consensus?
It certainly is early in the Old Testament.
Then
death is still a tragedy.
Are you trying to read something into Joel?
I think
this verse, it really isn't there,
right,
as far as a good Jew is concerned. Yeah.
Good question. That is, if there is any eschatology in Joel, only a Christian would find it. And they find it in verses like the ones we just read.
I talked to a Jew recently who now is an atheist, has no hope because he doesn't believe in any resurrection or see that God is doing anything for him right now.
There is
we should point out, I think we have to pursue this a little bit because it is an important subject and it does connect to what we're doing with Job. That at the very end of the Old Testament, you do have some statements that indicate a belief in the resurrection, like in Daniel and in Isaiah 24 and 26. And these are probably later passages. The Isaiah 24 to 27 is an apocalyptic thing. So it's written in apocalyptic literature that talks about the end of the world coming, where you find this kind of hope. And by the time of Jesus, remember, there were several different groups of Jews, and some of them believed in the resurrection and some didn't. And Jesus apparently belonged to the group that did. His thinking was much more like the Pharisees than it was like the Sadducees. And the Pharisees did believe in a resurrection, and they would read parts of the Old Testament like Christians would. That is, they would see hints of a belief in life after death that they took to be solid statements of that. Whereas the Sadducees were really the fundamentalists of the day. They read the Bible much more literally. When they read the Old Testament, they saw nothing there, especially in the Pentateuch, which was really the only part of the Old Testament that had authority for them. And when they read the Pentateuch, there was nothing in there about life after death, and therefore they did not believe it. And Jesus, remember, got in some arguments with Sadducees. And I can't remember the chapter that's in. Well, that's in a couple of different places. The one where the Sadducees come with a question about the woman whose husband dies, and then according to the Jewish custom, because it was important that they have descendants. See, the man died without any, but if his name is to be perpetuated, then his brother has to take his wife and try to have children through her. And you go through a whole series of something like, what, seven brothers? And the Sadducees are posing that as a kind of ridiculous question. A question that would put the logic of the life after death really to the test. Your people ask that same question if somebody is a widower or a widower at age 40 or something. You're supposed to get married again, or at any age. You're supposed to get married again. What are you going to do in heaven then when you've got all these husbands? Or what if a widow and a widower get together and they get married and then they get to heaven? So who's married to whom? People do ask questions like that. I don't know what the answers are. Jesus' answer was that in that particular passage that they're not going to be married in heaven. But they'll be like the angels. Maybe you don't like what Jesus said there, because a lot of people think life after death is when you're going to get back together with the people who are married. But he said you're not going to have it. Jesus didn't say very much about life after death, actually. And most of his statements are by people who came after him. He believed that it was there, but he was not saying too much about the specifics. See, he had that passage there, and he talked about a parable of a rich man and a poor man, and the poor man is now in Abraham's bosom. So that's what heaven is, you're going to be in Abraham's bosom. And there's no more detail. And then he talks a lot about hell, about people burning in hell, Gehenna. Kind of unpleasant stuff. You know, Jesus sometimes said some things that were pretty unpleasant. They make Old Testament prophets blush, some of the things that Jesus said. Well, anyway, the Sadducee passage, Jesus finally ends up quoting from Exodus 3, where God reveals himself to Moses with the name Yahweh and says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jesus says, God would not be the God of the dead, but of the living. Therefore, there is life after death. Now that is a good example of how a Christian could read the Old Testament, or a Pharisee could read the Old Testament and see things there that weren't there before. Because that passage obviously doesn't say anything about life after death. But you see, if you're looking for passages to show that, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God would not be the God of dead people, therefore those people must be alive, therefore there is life after death. And a Sadducee would say, that is not taking the Bible literally. You're reading all kinds of things in it. We can't allow that.
But aren't there religions that existed at that time that did believe in the life after death, couldn't do it?
There's certainly nothing unique about Christianity believing in life after death.
Like, couldn't Joel have this occurred to him, that he has believed this and gotten this into this passage?
Because if the belief finally did come into the Jewish thinking,
yeah,
there must
the
have been
Pharisees were the ones
pre-hints of it by some people.
Well, this King Tut stuff, you know, they didn't put all that stuff in there because they were burying it. They thought he was going to use it. So there's nothing unusual to believe in life after death. There's nothing at all unique about Christianity in that.
And there are these experiences of, what was it, life after life?
Yeah, I've read that.
Evidently, people have had that type of experience over the ages, and that would surely give them some feeling.
So how concrete is that view of what's going to happen next? At least, you know, the belief that God does have this thing that is controlling our life, that we've obliterated, that there is something beyond this life, is certainly an important part of a Christian faith. And how much of that Job has, of course, is not clearly evident. Not clear. I don't know exactly.
At least we can't rule it out.
No, I wouldn't rule it out.
I'm sorry I wasn't able to make your previous session, so you may have covered this, but do you date Job among the earlier literature of the Old Testament or later, like Ecclesiastes and so forth?
Well, not as late as Ecclesiastes. My watch stopped there. I wouldn't have been spending quite so much time on this. My guess is, and a lot of scholars are saying it now, that it probably comes at the early part of the Exile. Although there's an ancient story about Job that's very, very old, but the way the book gets shaped with these kinds of discussions of the meaning of evil seems to be appropriate at the time of the Exile. I can talk to you some more about that. We haven't gotten to the, we've got to say something about this. I mean, that, I think, is the main point of the book of Job, the way it appears to us now.
Could I ask you a question, just by reference to what you're saying? Doesn't it sometimes occur in history that one person will get a revelation that goes beyond anything that's occurring in his surroundings? Who was this great inventor who invented all this thought about flying and so on 1,000 years ago or so?
That's certainly
that kind of thing. So we can't always say that.
Well, that certainly would have been true at the time of Abraham. Yeah, sure. There's always some connection with what went before, but it could be very radically new. All the way through here now, Job is dealing with these people, and we've talked about how he really needs this confrontation with God. Okay, so he finally gets it. In chapter 38, God speaks to Job. God had not said a word up till now. At least there's no telling. The conversation was all at the human level. And when he finally talks, he puts Job down in a sense. Who are you to raise these kinds of questions? You're only a human being, he says. I'm God. Where were you when I created the world? And then a good part of the speeches here has to do with all of this creation imagery. You know, how can Job raise such questions when he doesn't know how to make a blade of grass, or how to make the mountain goats, or how to make the hippopotamus? And all of these things, and goes on in great detail to describe the wonders of nature. And who are you to know that? It's like sitting out here watching at the stars. Who are you to even raise the question? I'm God. Who are you? Okay. Now, and at the end, there's a little interlude in the middle where there's a break, and Job responds and says, "Okay, I'll keep my mouth shut." And then God talks some more, and then finally, Job says, in the beginning of chapter 42, "I know that thou canst do all things, that no purpose of thine can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me. I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. That's an important verse, I think. Therefore, I despise myself and repent of dust and ashes. Okay, now we're not going to have time to really talk about this, but I hinted yesterday that I think the answer, really, of Job is that there is no answer. That is, there is no rational, cognitive answer. There's no absolute way of saying it, whether it's in philosophical terms or theological terms or whatever, that adequately accounts for every case of suffering or evil. And we have all kinds of answers that may work partially at particular times. What is crucial in the answer from Job is that God cares and has spoken. And then somehow Job comes to the assurance that God is still there, and you get the feeling that he can handle it now. That is, somehow this faith that he had once has been brought back. He knows God is still there. He doesn't even mind that God's given him a bad time in these speeches. Because the problem is not just a rational one of my way of coming up with some kind of an answer that helps, but it's a problem of my faith, of whether God is there and I believe that. And I think that when we go through times of sorrow, despair, and so on, we also come at it on two different levels. There's the problem of understanding what's happening. There's also the question of, you know, how can I keep living? How can I survive? Where is God? And there is just no easy way to get people through that. To get people to the point where somehow that faith is maintained, the strength to get up.
I think in my own life, oftentimes when I'm struggling with who is in control, myself or God, it often just has to come down to the point where I succeed in my quest.
Where you what?
Kind of just let go of the quest and wanting somehow to comprehend all that is and accept the mystery and accept also that God is in control and somehow...
That's exactly the point where Job ends up. Again, you can't do that too soon.
No, it's a struggle.
Because you hear people talking about submitting to God and giving it all up, just letting go, don't raise the question. But it took how many chapters before Job got here? It took all of this chance to talk about it, talking to other people, talking to God. And the problem, again, is that you can make that into too easy an answer. Where you have to just trust God, just be submissive, let go of it, quit worrying about it. And that can be, of course, a disastrous.
I think
and yet, that's where you want people to be.
Well, I think it's a reoccurring theme throughout our lives. I think there's a point when, like the other day, one of the women brought up the point that it's just being able to trust. And then she would say that, well, somehow in her experience, she probably found that out. And yet there might be another time in her life or another time in my own life where I would once again have to undergo the struggle and again have to reach that conclusion. I think that the faith-doubt struggle is so much a part of Job in each of our own lives. And it's a reoccurring theme from birth until, death for most of us.
And sometimes it feels like God is there, other than you're insecure.
I think you see this so often in a hospital when people are sick, that they say, well, it's in God's hands, and there's nothing I can do about it. And I'm just gonna let God take care of it. And they really do give up. And they're willing to die. There's nothing that medicine or a physician or a good nursing can do for that particular person. They just will themselves to die. And for, just like some people are just opposite. They say, pray devoutly and hammer stoutly. I'm going to pray as hard as I can, and I'm going to keep fighting in here because it's a matter of teamwork. And you see this as you work with people that are ill in the hospital. You see this working for them.
Let me put up, there are two places where some of you, if you are interested, can follow up a little bit on it. We obviously haven't solved all this. Vernon Pietah is going to have a discussion of Isaiah 53 this afternoon at 4. And that's the stuff about the suffering servant and so on. And that, I think, will be dealing with some of the same things. And then tomorrow morning at this time, I'm going to talk some about Psalm 22. which is a lament psalm that is particularly an important lament psalm because it's the one that Jesus quotes from the cross. So I think we can maybe talk a little more about laments, a lot of things that relate to what we've done here, and maybe getting a little stuff about the cross and so on, how that might fit.